From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It often seems like there aren't enough police to protect us against thieves and muggers. That's why many neighborhoods have started their own crime watch patrols. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Judge Richard Neely, the author of a new book about how to organize a crime watch group, and we hear from the co-founder of one such group in Philadelphia. Violence has become a way of life for a lot of young people growing up in poor urban neighborhoods. That's the predicament of the characters in the movie Boys in the Hood. Coming up, we meet the director and writer of the film, John Singleton. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council today continued discussing whether to allow Iraq to sell oil to buy food, medicine, and supplies for civilian needs. Meanwhile, there was no response from Iraq to a demand by some Security Council members that it come clean about its nuclear program. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Last month, the five permanent members of the Security Council gave Iraq until today to disclose full details about its nuclear capabilities. Some council members, including the U.S., say Iraqi reports to date have been insufficient. But the deadline passed today with no more word from Iraq. U.S. and other Western officials downplayed the suggestion that they might pursue military action against Iraq if it doesn't come clean. And Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said he did not believe an attack was imminent.
Nothing in the statement which I have heard means that they are about to start tomorrow any military action.
Security Council members spent part of the day discussing whether to allow Iraq to sell a limited amount of oil. Diplomats said if any sale is permitted, the UN will have to control how the revenues are spent. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa said today that his country agreed to take part in a U.S.-sponsored Middle East peace process after receiving assurances from President Bush. Al-Sharaa said that President Bush sent a letter to Syrian leader Hafez al-Assad assuring him that Israel would have to withdraw from all occupied territories as part of a peace agreement. The statement contradicts a pledge from Secretary of State James Baker, who said last week in Damascus that the U.S. would give no secret assurances to any party in the peace process. The government issued new regulations today aimed at eliminating discrimination against disabled Americans. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Americans with Disabilities Act is a wide-ranging law aimed at protecting the disabled from discrimination in hiring, public accommodations, and transportation. Advocates for the disabled are not entirely pleased with the rules implementing the act, including one that allows employers to refuse to hire a disabled applicant if it's proved the applicant would pose a safety risk to himself or others. Chris Bell, an attorney at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission who helped draft the regulations, denies they are a loophole.
The commission feels that that is a very stringent standard, and its existence operates to outlaw many common employment practices that are currently screening people out.
The regulations will affect all employers with 25 or more workers starting in a year. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street as investors apparently shook off worries about disappointing second-quarter earnings reports from some major corporations. The Dow Industrials gained 14 points to close at 2,980. This is NPR. A House Judiciary Subcommittee voted today to subpoena documents from the Justice Department about allegations that Reagan administration officials stole a valuable computer program. The panel took the step after its chairman, Texas Democrat Jack Brooks, charged that Justice had been slow to comply with requests for information and said that some of the requested documents were missing. Brooks is investigating charges that the Justice Department stole computer software from the Inslaw Company, then tried to manipulate the bankruptcy laws to destroy the company. The seven regional telephone companies today received approval to provide a broad array of information services over their phone lines. NPR's John Idsty reports.
The 1982 consent decree that broke the AT&T telephone monopoly prohibited the regional telephone companies, or baby bells, from providing information services like home shopping and stock market quotes. U.S. District Judge Harold Green, who presided over the breakup of the AT&T system, thought if the regional companies had that power, they would squeeze out competitors and develop unfair monopolies which would harm consumers. Today, Green reluctantly backed down under pressure from an appellate court. But Green delayed the effective date of his ruling to allow those who oppose allowing the baby bells into the market time to appeal. Among the opponents are MCI, the American Newspaper Publishers Association, and consumer groups. I'm John Itzty in Washington.
The Justice Department said today that it's actively investigating the American operations of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Justice Department spokesman Robert Mueller also denied that the investigation has been hindered by the Central Intelligence Agency. Over the weekend, Time magazine reported that BCCI was involved in handling funds for arms dealers, drug lords, and the CIA. The magazine report said that the Justice Department attempted to prevent investigations into the bank, in part to protect the CIA. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In some urban neighborhoods, it's getting difficult to find someone who hasn't been the victim of a crime. Some communities are taking matters into their own hands by forming crime watch groups that patrol the neighborhood. Many of these groups see themselves as the eyes and ears of the police. But other groups are more militant and try to intervene and make citizens' arrests. My guest, Richard Neely, is a justice on the West Virginia Supreme Court. He's written a new book about crime watch groups called Take Back Your Neighborhood. Neely believes crime watch groups are essential these days because the police are incapable of protecting us.
The average police patrolman, whether it be in Charleston, West Virginia, or Chicago, Illinois, or Los Angeles, California, only spends approximately 5% of his active working time patrolling. The rest of the time, he's answering domestic violence calls, he's regulating traffic, he's taking routine police reports for paperwork purposes so that people can put in for their insurance. He may be doing a little bit of investigation with regard to crimes that have already happened. But the last thing that he does is patrol. Now, what you want to do is not catch criminals after the fact. You want to keep the crime from happening in the first place. And the only correlation between crime rates and any police activity is between crime rates and a police patrolling activity that is so intensive, so open, notorious, and visible that the bad guys really believe that there is a high likelihood that they're going to be caught.
A lot of communities and businesses rely on private security forces instead of on the police. In fact, you give an interesting statistic in your book. The number of private security forces compared to the police are 2 to 1 in favor of the private forces. The way you describe it is that a lot of residential communities have created privatized space. What do you mean by that?
If you've got money, what you do is get yourself either a fortified city building, literally fortified, where you have locked doors, television monitors, underground garages that open only to authorized people with special keys, special elevators, and you just keep the bad guys out as if you were Fort Knox, or you set up a community like Kiowa Island, South Carolina, where you have a large number of houses all surrounded by a nice high fence or a natural barrier like a waterway, and in order to get in there, you must identify yourself at a guard post, give your name, give your business, say who you're visiting, etc. And the result is that in places where the space has been privatized, the crime rate is vanishingly small.
So your argument is if the rich are going to hire their own guards to protect themselves, then the middle class and the working class and the poor, if they can, need to organize to protect themselves since they can no longer really rely on the police.
Well, they never could rely on the police.
Right, that's the point you made before. Okay, so let's talk about the kind of community patrol you have in mind.
Let's talk about vigilantes first.
Yeah, you use the word vigilante. This is a word most people, like me, for instance, I hate that word. I always think of people who are going beyond the law to take matters into their own hands, you know, who want to organize a lynching.
Right, that's wrong, because there are good vigilantes and there are bad vigilantes. Obviously, the bad vigilantes you don't want to imitate, and the good vigilantes you want to encourage. The bad vigilantes are the Chinese Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution, or the Nazi Brown Shirts, or the American Ku Klux Klan. These are not criminal vigilantes. These are a bunch of thugs enforcing self-serving social and economic policies through the force of arms on an unwilling population. They have nothing whatsoever to do with enforcing the law. The good vigilantes are the traditional American posse. Now, when I was young, and when a lot of our listeners were young, you'd go to the grade C cowboy movies, and the posse was always an object of obloquy, ridicule, and contempt. They were always some pus-gutted old burghers who were riding nags for horses and couldn't shoot straight, and so they were always a ludicrous looking group of folks. The truth of the matter is that the law in America up until the 1930s in most places outside the major cities was still largely enforced by the use of posses and by the use of citizens. So that is a legal, traditional, acceptable way to enforce the law and was even required in England all the way up through the 19th century. In England today, police officers don't carry guns, and the reason is that police officers are thought to be nothing other than ordinary citizens who have been paid to do what the ordinary citizen is expected to do for nothing. Finally, the towering monument to the legitimacy of criminal vigilantes is the continued vitality of the power of citizens' arrest in the United States. Almost every state in the Union provides citizens with substantially the same powers that police officers have. In some states, the power of citizens' arrest has been narrowed somewhat by statute. But everywhere there is the right, for example, to apprehend a fleeing felon, to arrest people who are placing the community in imminent danger.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Neely, and he's a justice on the West Virginia Supreme Court, former chief justice, and he's the author of the new book, Take Back Your Neighborhood, Organizing a Citizens Patrol Force to Fight Crime in Your Community. Now, the kind of group I'm familiar with is your neighborhood town watch group, in which volunteers from the neighborhood drive around making sure that there's nothing that they can see that is going wrong, nobody being mugged or raped, no houses being broken into. Is that the kind of community group that you have in mind?
Yeah, that's one kind. In your area, they use cars. In the city areas, the urban areas, it is much better to walk. And there are a number of do's and don'ts in this thing. The big don't is don't ever allow anybody to carry a firearm. Absolutely no guns. There are too many bad guys out there with guns to start with. If the drug dealers have Uzis and AK-47s and M-16s, that is not a job for citizens. That is a job for the police or the SWAT team. It is not a job for ordinary people. But the common run-of-the-mind rapist, murderer, armed robber, vandal, car thief, burglar, right, is not armed. He's not very brave, and more than likely, he's a bit of a coward. These people will respond by leaving when they see active citizen patrol forces. Consequently, your people have got to have uniforms. In the book, I talk about the value of dressing up like the Canadian Royal Mounted Police with an enormous red jacket and blue trousers and a huge Yogi Bear hat, because that's a uniform that can be seen a mile away. But unfortunately, it costs about $500. But the Metro Orange Coalition in Washington, D.C., managed to have a very distinctive uniform for under $30, and that's an orange windbreaker, an orange baseball cap, an orange T-shirt, all in sort of day glow neon orange that is very, very visible.
What techniques have you seen citizens groups use to try to stop a mugging or a rape or a robbery that's already in progress?
Well, usually if uniformed citizens approach a crime in progress, whoever is committing the crime runs. That's the first thing. The Guardian Angels in New York have been very successful at protecting women in subway stations, for example, from being hassled by the normal macho juvenile gang. And the way that they do it is that they just walk up next to the woman and stand there. And that immediately eliminates the woman's fear because she knows that there is someone who is committed to protecting her, who looks reasonably competent because there are two or three of these people, guardian angels, together. And whoever is doing the hassling, unless he's mentally ill, and you often have that problem too, by the way, will just go away.
I know you're really in favor of the guardian angels. Now, some of their critics say that this is a group that's really into this macho ethic. They're warriors who like to fight, and they can therefore be provocative. And also groups like the guardian angels end up taking away control from the police. What do you think?
I think that's nonsense. I think the guardian angels are a group of teenagers, primarily, and young adults, who have decided that they are going to make a difference and that they are going to very visibly join the good guys rather than the bad guys. There have actually been studies and polls taken in New York where the approval rating of the guardian angels is roughly 73%, which is just phenomenal. Hardly anything gets an approval rating of 73% in government or in civic affairs. And you say, well, is this thing not subject to abuse? Of course it's subject to abuse. Everything's subject to abuse. The King case out in Los Angeles demonstrates in very graphic terms, because it was videotaped, that there is police brutality out there. What's amazing is that people don't realize that it is certainly not limited to the Los Angeles police force. There is police brutality in every small town, every small city, every medium-sized city, every big city, and even every rural sheriff's office in America. Police brutality goes with the policing territory. And so you say, aren't these people liable to violate ordinary citizens' civil rights and civil liberties? The answer to that is yes, they are likely to violate the ordinary citizens' civil rights and civil liberties. But they are much, 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 much less likely to violate the ordinary citizen's civil rights and civil liberties than the police. The police are really the great violators of people's civil rights and civil liberties. And I'm not just being disparaging of the police. I have a high regard for most police officers. I think that in many instances, they are real heroes. Many of them give their lives in the defense of law and order. But I am not a Dr. Pangloss. You know, I'm not naive. There is a lot of police brutality out there, and it is concentrated in brutal acts largely against the underclass, whether it's the minority underclass or just the down-and-out white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male underclass. Largely people who do not have the social, political, or economic resources to do anything about it.
Richard Neely is my guest, Justice on the West Virginia Supreme Court and author of the book Take Back Your Neighborhood. If you have a neighborhood crime watch group, there's a chance that someone in the group would be held liable for false arrest or for intimidation or something like that. What kind of liability protection do you think a crime watch group needs to have?
Well, actually, I'm very elaborate about that in the book. The truth of the matter is that if you are in a working class neighborhood or a lower middle class neighborhood and you don't own a lot of property, don't have a lot of equity in your house, you don't really have to worry. Lawyers don't sue people who don't have money. Lawyers work on contingent fees. If the guy doesn't have any money to get, even if you get a judgment, nobody bothers to sue you. Now, if you're in a middle-class neighborhood or an upper-middle-class neighborhood where, say, the older people in the group already own their own house, have money in the bank, have pension rights that people can levy on, then, indeed, you better go through the motion of forming a corporation and having that insulation from liability, and then buying an insurance policy. And I even tell you in the book, the guy you can call out in Minneapolis who can get you an insurance policy for this kind of a group if you don't have a local guy who's able to do it for you.
Tell me about one case or one incident that you've had to deal with in your work as a judge that helped shape your view of crime and crime prevention in America.
Oh, it isn't any one case. I review somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 criminal cases a year, perhaps even more this year. I just see crime after crime after crime after crime. And the level of violence, of savagery that comes before me makes me terribly fearful. I mean, I fear for myself, I fear for my wife, I fear for my children, and that's even when I live in a state that has the lowest crime rate in the country.
Richard Neely is the author of Take Back Your Neighborhood. We'll hear from a member of a Crime Watch group after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We called the co-founder of a Town Watch group in West Mount Airy, an integrated neighborhood of families and young professionals in Philadelphia. Mark Hartsfield grew up in the neighborhood, and when he recently returned to live there, he was disturbed by the increase in crime. Hartsfield is a service manager at a car dealership. We caught up with him on a pay phone while he was on a camping trip. I asked him if he had been the victim of a crime before starting the group a couple of years ago. He told me the story of a crime he witnessed and tried to stop.
My neighbor, the door was ajar to her apartment, and it appeared to have been kicked, and the room ransacked. So when I stepped in, I stumbled onto this situation. The perpetrator was armed with a knife, and we tussled about on the balcony, and subsequently he was by myself thrown over the balcony. We were not able to catch him. After checking on her condition, a neighbor and myself tried to chase him. It was unbelievable. From a second-story balcony, this young man got up and was able to run, limp, or elude us. The police responded almost immediately, and he was never found. I believe he was hiding or perhaps being harbored by someone in the area.
Now that you're in a Crime Watch group, if you had walked in on a rape again, would you have done anything differently than you did then?
If I had walked in, if I had stumbled into a situation, I probably would not have done anything different. However, it's very likely that before entering a situation like that, if I was close enough to a phone, I would call the police and notify them of the suspicious nature of what I was observing.
Your Crime Watch group is supposed to be the eyes and ears for the police, right? You're not supposed to try to apprehend people yourself, make a citizen's arrest. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. Our patrollers are cautioned on patrol tactics. We ask them to stay in their cars, those that do the car patrol, keep their doors locked, keep their windows lowered to a point where they can hear, and anything that they see or that they hear that appear to be suspicious, report it to the police, not to take action themselves. Because you never know when an individual is breaking the law, whether they're going to harm you because you pose a threat to them. So by all means, we are the eyes and ears of the police force. The police department in our area was, 8 years ago, about a 29-car police department for our district. It's now, on any given day, as low as 10 and as high as 15. So we've lost about half of the manpower that the police department has had to offer in the last 8 years. And this makes for a very difficult time for the police to patrol that area. We have a very large district. Our district is one of the largest in the city.
Tell me what a typical shift is like for you.
A typical shift is uneventful, fortunately. And that is something that can become boring, but hopefully doesn't become boring to a point where people stop patrolling. And a typical patrol would be driving street by street through the neighborhood, making note of any abandoned automobiles, And we also, from time to time, will try to report street lights out, any traffic signal that fails to work, anything to keep our watchers busy in our neighborhood, to report those things to the city, because they also help to deter crime. You know, and a street light that's not lit on a block, that's never lit on a block, that's the type of thing that someone surveying the area for crime recognizes and maybe somewhere where they choose to hit.
Can you tell me your personal reasons for joining a Crime Watch group?
Well, I've lived in this community most of my life. I grew up on the street where I live now, and I'd just like to see it stay a safe place to raise my children. I have two small boys, and I don't want to see our community end up like some in the city, where people don't care or aren't willing to take a risk to try and help the community. There are a lot of places in this country where crime is second nature to people. That's not something that we're willing to, or that I am willing to accept for my community.
Can you tell how effective your Crime Watch group is?
Well, about 6 months ago, the statistics showed that crime was down 18 to 23% in our part of the police district. And that was directly due to the Town Watch effort in the neighborhood.
Let me ask you, you're on a camping trip now with your family, yes?
That's correct.
Is anybody watching your home while you're gone?
Yes. My brother also lives nearby, and other neighbors in the Town Watch. That's something that we encourage people to do, to notify members of Town Watch when you go away, so that people can pick up your newspapers or get your mail. In my case, I have a cat that has to be fed, so that's something that we offer and something that we ask our watchers to do.
Mark Hartsfield is a co-founder of a Town Watch group in the Philadelphia neighborhood of West Mount Airy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet John Singleton, the writer and director of the new film Boys in the Hood. There was violence in several theaters the weekend it opened, but the film's message is against gangs and for strong families. It's a coming-of-age story set in a South Central Los Angeles neighborhood where violence is becoming a way of life. Also, film critic Owen Gleiberman gives his diagnosis of the new movie The Doctor, starring William Hurt as a surgeon who has to learn what it's like to be a patient. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The CIA, which has dismissed allegations of extensive involvement in the scandal-ridden Bank of Commerce and Credit International, has now announced an internal probe to uncover any dealings it may have had with BCCI. NPR's Neil Conan has more.
A CIA statement said that Director William Webster had asked the agency's inspector general to review past contacts the agency may have had with BCCI. A spokesman stressed that the review is not based on any evidence of wrongdoing and that its purpose was to provide congressional oversight committees with all the relevant information. Several reports say the CIA did maintain accounts with BCCI that it used in connection with covert operations in Afghanistan, Nicaragua, and elsewhere. More damning reports say the CIA and other U.S. intelligence services were deeply involved in illegal activities using BCCI services and that they blocked U.S. government investigations of the bank that might have uncovered that relationship. Attorney General Richard Thornburg denied that there was any interference from the CIA or that the Justice Department had dragged its feet on the investigation. There is no effort to cover up anything, Thornburg said. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
White House officials have accused Iraq of playing a shell game in efforts to get around a UN deadline for reporting all of its weapons of mass destruction. At the same time, officials indicated that military action against Iraq is not near. A U.S. spokesman said July 25th was not a deadline for military action. It's the date set by the UN for Iraq to report all of its nuclear weapons capability. Soviet leader Gorbachev has called on fellow communists to adopt a radical new political platform that rejects many long-held principles in favor of greater democracy and a mixed economy. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev issued his appeal at a meeting of the Communist Party's Policymaking Central Committee. The communist leader warned that without changes, the party will lose ground in the newly competitive world of Soviet politics. Gorbachev told the Central Committee that more than 4 million communists have resigned from the party over the past 18 months. The party still claims 15 million members, making it by far the largest political movement in the Soviet Union. But its public prestige has dwindled, and opposition candidates have easily defeated communists in many local elections. Gorbachev hopes his new program can restore the party's political credibility and boost its candidates in national elections. The Central Committee is expected to endorse the program tomorrow. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 14 points to close at 2,980.10 on a volume of some 145 million shares. This is NPR News. The Senate Finance Committee has voted to give the long-term unemployed up to 5 more months of jobless benefits. Democratic leaders want full Senate action next week before Congress adjourns. Senate sponsor of the measure, Lloyd Benson of Texas, contends that the bill is needed to help the 2 million people who have lost jobs since the start of the recession. The measure was approved in committee by a vote of 16-4. The 4 Republicans who opposed it said that the cost of the measure makes it unacceptable without spending cuts or a tax increase. South African Foreign Minister Pik Botha has faced his critics in the week-old scandal over covert government funding of the Inkatha movement. And NPR's John Madison reports that the minister's mood was defiant.
In an hour-long televised program today, Pik Botha said he'd funded Inkatha's rallies secretly because they would show the international media that many black people opposed sanctions against South Africa. He said he did not apologize for the decision and he'd do it all again if the circumstances of those times were repeated. He denied that President F.W. de Klerk knew about the funding, but he said he was not legally required to know. Buerta's defense of the police was particularly weak, though. He admitted that a police document leaked to the press showed that senior police officers wanted money for Inkatha to help it in its purely political fight against Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. Buerta did not comment on whether that was proper. He just said that document was never shown to him. I'm John Matteson in Johannesburg.
In a statement at odds with Israel, France says that Palestinians from East Jerusalem should be represented at a U.S.-sponsored Middle Eastern peace conference. Yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Shamir said that his government would take part in Middle Eastern peace talks only if Palestinians from East Jerusalem were not included. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The movie Boys in the Hood made news the first weekend it opened because of violence in several theaters that left over 30 people injured and one dead. But the more enduring story is about the film's critical and commercial success and the emergence of a new young talent, the 23-year-old screenwriter and director John Singleton. The movie is a semi-autobiographical story of growing up in South Central Los Angeles, where the gunfire of rival gangs is an upsetting but common sound. Trey, the main character, is the only one of his friends who lives with his father. And his father, named Furious, is a strong role model, working tirelessly to teach Trey how to be a good and responsible man. But one of Trey's best friends, played by the rap music star Ice Cube, has a criminal record, owns a gun, and is willing to use it. The movie preaches against violence and for strong families. I asked Singleton if the violence at theaters 2 weeks ago has affected the distribution of the film.
Not adversely. What happened was there were violent incidents on the first day of release, the first night of release. And since then, everything has quelled, and we've added 100 theaters. And I'd say nothing really bad has happened.
What about the theaters where there was violence? Did they change anything? Are they still showing the movie?
Some theaters took the movie out and then they put it back in a couple of days later, and some people decided not to show the film at all.
You know, it's funny, the weekend that I was reading about violence in the theaters, I went to see it in a theater, and everybody where I saw it was weeping, you know, at the very sad scenes in it.
Yeah. It's a very heartfelt movie, you know. It, unlike a lot of films now, you actually feel for the characters in the film because they've been developed.
When you sold the script for Boys in the Hood, you insisted on directing it yourself. I was wondering what the movie was like in your mind when you envisioned an assigned director doing it.
I never could envision an assigned director. That'd be like selling my mother, you know what I'm saying? that'd be like selling one of my relatives to someone. Can you imagine somebody like Alan Parker trying to direct Boys in the Hood? You know, it would probably end up Furious would be a Baptist minister, and Trey would be a choir boy, and at the end of the movie, Doughboy would sing a gospel song. So I don't think anybody else could have directed this film outside of myself.
Alan Parker is, by the way, the person who directed Mississippi Burning, among other things, for our listeners who are trying to figure out which director he is. So you thought it would be shown in things that would end up being stereotypical and generationally and locationally all wrong.
I couldn't let nobody from Iowa or, you know what I'm saying, or Idaho or even Encino direct this film. It had to be directed by somebody who lived it.
Do you have any friends who were killed?
A couple.
Yeah?
Yes.
What were the circumstances?
Well, I have a friend, one friend, his name was Robbie Stringer. He got killed because in the mid-80s, when cocaine was made cheaper in the form of crack, you know, because that only happened in the early 80s, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started getting involved in the trade and stuff, and he got killed when he was 17. He got killed in an alley down the street from my house. It really changed my neighborhood. Just like, you know, when one of the kids in the film gets killed. changes everybody's life.
How did it change your life?
It was like a crux in which all these things that were happening growing up in the early 80s were like coming to fruition, and I was realizing that there was a certain system in order to that was working towards, you know, my demise, you know, and to bring me down. I could just look around. I can remember being able to go to the park, and when I was a kid, and there would always be a park supervisor there. You could check out a basketball, or baseball, whatever. And after certain laws were passed here in this country, in the Reagan administration, and Proposition 13 here in Los Angeles County, tax money didn't go towards park supervisors or anything, and social programs and stuff was being taken away. And I could see that, you know. So what does a park become then? The park becomes a turf. It doesn't become a recreational facility. You know, I can remember when Ronald Reagan deemed ketchup to be a vegetable. I was in sixth grade.
Did you start eating a lot of ketchup? I remember.
Yeah, and so I'm a product of the last decade, and now I'm out for change. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the 90s, so I'm ready to deal a new hand.
No, Boys in the Hood is a lot of it is about the importance of having a father around, a strong father.
That's right.
As a good role model, and also to kind of discipline you and teach you the difference between right and wrong.
There's a whole population of young people, black, white, whatever, that don't have a strong father figure or a strong family background, for that matter. Most people don't even talk to their kids, all right? And the deal is that it's my belief that a young boy needs a man how to teach him how to be a man. A woman cannot teach him how to do that. She can only teach him her perception of what she believes a man to be. And as a result of this, since we have a whole population of young men that don't have father figures and don't have that direction, they're always in pursuit of their manhood. You see? They're always going to be not really in tune with themselves as young men, and throughout their lives searching for a sense of being what being a man is.
Did you have a strong father?
Yes. My father was the model for Furious.
And in the movie, the parents of the main character are separated. Your parents were separated too?
My parents never married, but they were still good parents, you know.
So who did you live with?
I lived with my mother for a certain period of time, and then when I turned 11, I went to live with my father.
It's kind of like the character in the movie.
It's exactly like the character in the movie.
Now, in the movie, the character changes because the mother kind of made a pact with the father that if discipline became a real problem with their son, that she would send him over to the father and have him live with the father. Was that what happened with you?
Yes, it was.
What were you getting into that was a warning sign to your mother?
Just, you know, fighting too much and getting into some certain things that I shouldn't have been getting into. I was on the wrong path, and I needed to be guided onto the right path, and that's why I went to live with my father.
What did your father do to lay down the law right away?
He taught me a sense of responsibility. He made me work around the house. He taught me to value myself and my culture and where I was, you know, where and it respect him, you know. And, you know, I looked up to my father like most people look up to Superman. You see?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Know what we're saying?
I wanted to know if you ever defied your father.
Yeah, a couple of times we got into it and stuff. You know, I didn't do everything my pops told me. I wouldn't be here right now. You know, I remember my father wanted me to go into real estate. And I was like, no. He's like, real estate is the way to go. You can get your license before you finish college. I was like, no, I'm going to be a filmmaker. You know, so I don't do everything my father tells me.
My guest is John Singleton. He's the director and writer of the new film, Boys in the Hood. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Singleton, the director and writer of Boys in the Hood, a new movie about a young man surrounded by violence but guided away from it by a strong father. The only problem I have with the message of your movie is that I think mothers get a bad rap. Like, it's not possible for a mother to do a good job bringing up a son.
No, it is possible, but the thing is that a mother has to understand that mothering is only one aspect of parenting, okay? Husbandry and fatherhood is another aspect of parenting. And if you only have one without the other, if you only have fatherhood and you don't have motherhood, then you don't have a complete person. If you only have motherhood and you don't have fatherhood, then you don't have a complete person. So a mother who has no other alternatives, that doesn't have a husband or doesn't have someone there for that person to set down rules and guidelines and give direction, needs to find other ways in which her young son can, you know, just get a chance to have that guidance from a male. It could be a minister, you know. It can be whatever. It can be, that's what's needed. Basically, that's what's needed, straight up. I'm not giving mothers a bad rap. It's just that I'm making a statement that the American family has been broken down within the last 25 years. And only now are we really seeing the effects of that.
Were you ever looked on by some of your friends as too much of the good kid of
Oh, heck no.
Okay.
I've always been a psychological person.
Uh-huh.
I've always been a kind of person that could sway attitudes and sway weak-minded people into certain directions, whether or not they wanted to or not go into that direction.
This is a great trait to have as a filmmaker. How did you use it as a teenager?
Well, I mean, there are certain people I could get to do certain things that they ordinarily wouldn't do. My father always taught me to be a leader and not a follower, to work smarter and not harder. And so if you have a certain population of people that are followers, they're easy to be led. And they're easy to be led through the power of the way you speak to them. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so, my father taught me to value that. And also, I learned that a lot from comic books, too. I mean, no, you learn a lot from comic books. You read comic books, and you have certain characters who are kings and who consider themselves royalty, and certain people who command respect, like Dr. Doom and stuff, and you look at the way they speak and the way they, you know, they describe them in the stories about how they walk and everything, and you know that you know what they're about and everything. And as a kid, I internalized that, me and my little friends, you know. And so I had my little pack, just like, you know, Doughboy, Ricky, and Trey.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up on Vermont and Hunter first, and in a part of South L.A. known as Inglewood, in the flight path of LAX. And it was rough, but it wasn't as rough as it is now, because, you know, the neighborhood is now seeing the after effects of the last decade of the big burgeoning crack trade, and it's suffering because of that. Now just now trying to get back up.
Now, did you shoot Boys in the Hood in the neighborhood that it's supposed to be set in South Central L.A.?
Yes, I did.
In the credits for the movie, you thank the Nation of Islam. Did they provide security for the movie?
There's a security company in which there are brothers that are members of the Fruit of Islam, which is the security force of the Nation of Islam. And it's a private security company, they're just, some of their members are members of the Nation of Islam.
So you used them for security?
Yes, I did.
And were there, yeah.
That's the only people that the kids are going to respect. You see, gang members respect the FOI before they respect the police.
What is it about the Fruit of Islam that gets that kind of respect?
What'd you say?
What is it about the members of Fruit of Islam that gets that kind of respect?
Because of the fact that they're figureheads, and they're strong black men in the face of young black men who have no direction, and when they see these strong, responsible, well-groomed, clean-cut, strong-minded black men walk and politely tell them to do something, they're going to do it. You see, it's a whole psychological chunking because of the fact that these young men don't come in contact with a strong black man. So it's automatic, immediate respect.
Boys in the Hood has gotten very good reviews. It's doing really well at the box office. How is that going to affect the next movie that you make? Do you know what that movie will be? Are you getting surprising offers?
I'm writing my next film right now.
Mm-hmm.
And my next film is going to be even more experimental. I mean, now that I've done something like this, it allows me to be more free and with my work. And it's going to be about the war between black men and women on an economic level, you know. It's a romance. it's like, you know, it's a straight-up street romance. And since it deals with emotions and love, it's even more dangerous than Boys in the Hood. So maybe you'll have couples shooting each other in the theaters. No, not for real. I'm just joking. I'm wondering whether or not I'm going to be able to get a date after this movie.
Well, John Singleton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. All right. Peace out.
John Singleton wrote and directed Boys in the Hood. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Stories tonight about the Bank of Commerce and Credit International scandal and its worldwide involvement. Also, Neil Conan will explore who's been watching over the bank's operation in the U.S. From Moscow, the story of the Central Committee meeting getting underway, the Communist Party there. Mikhail Gorbachev is trying to move his party away from communist doctrine. Ann Cooper has that story. We'll have letters from listeners about autonomy in Spain and more slogans for towns in Wisconsin, including this one, Appleton, we've never heard of you either. And Bob Mondello looks at recent portrayals in the movies of fathers and children.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, The Doctor, reunites actor William Hurt and director Randa Haynes, who last collaborated on the film version of Children of a Lesser God. Owen Gleiberman has a review.
William Hurt has always been a highly cerebral, almost implosive actor. Everything about him, from his edgy smile to his feverish monotone, suggests a man at war with his own passion. Recently, though, an oddball daze has settled over Hurt's intensity. In movies like Broadcast News and The Accidental Tourist, he's had the spaced-out demeanor of a man sleepwalking. So I'm pleased to report that his charismatic obsessiveness has returned in The Doctor. Hurt's character, Jack McKee, is a San Francisco heart surgeon who has spent so many years slicing into patients that he no longer sees them as human beings. Right away, this movie lets you know it's going to be about how doctors really operate. Jack and his surgeon buddies are a kind of superstar boys' club. As they barrel down the hall, making jokes at their patients' expense, the movie dips beneath the cliché of the caring doctor to show us the cool, sometimes heartless bravado of modern physicians. Then, fate turns the tables on Jack. He is diagnosed with throat cancer and put in the lowly position of being a patient. It's likely a surgeon as prominent as Jack McKee would get more preferential treatment than he does here. Nevertheless, his outrage at being reduced to one of the herd rings devastatingly true. Here, he has to deal with the bureaucratic inefficiency of trying to get his radiation treatments.
I'm sorry, Dr. Reed can't be here this morning.
No, no, why not?
Well, he's been held up. I think there's some ad-mid meeting all day today.
When do I see him?
He'll be here next week.
No, look, if I can't see him today, I'll see him tomorrow.
We close weekends. I'll be right there, Carol.
I was told this was to be a daily treatment.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't make the rules.
Why don't we, from now on, in this hospital, we should drop "I'm sorry" from conversation, okay? Let's just assume it begins every sentence. I'm sorry the doctor can't see you today. I'm sorry you have to fill in another form. I'm sorry we gave you the wrong treatment. What do we think?
Director Randa Haines has captured the frustration and fear of the modern medical experience. As Jack faces what his patients have had to go through, his ordeal becomes a heightened version of what any of us might feel when a serious illness strikes. Gradually, he regains his compassion. In outline, the doctor isn't all that different from a bogus piece of uplift like Regarding Henry. But this film touches on something subtler and more believable. It's about a man who has stopped responding to what's in front of him, and about how he slowly opens his eyes. The doctor is far from flawless. Jack's marriage is supposed to have grown cold because of his dedication to his career. When he meets a fellow cancer patient, played by Elizabeth Perkins, the two of them talk, bond, and take a mystical trip to the desert, and she becomes a kind of replacement for his wife. Even so, we needed to see the marriage sketched in more. As Jack's wife, the always vibrant Christine Lottie, is saddled with a drastically underwritten part. She just ends up seeming like a well-meaning nudge. Still, if there are moments when the movie is too pat, Hurt's performance is fully alive. He brings an inquisitive fear and yearning to even the most under-imagined scenes. By the end, we feel we've been through a highly specific journey of emotional discovery. The doctor is funny, dramatic, and beautifully observant. It's that rare thing, a tearjerker that respects its audience.
Owen Globerman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. You can share your thoughts about Fresh Air with us by calling our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Joan Tui, Roberta Shurrock, and Robbie Harris. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn investigate the long, covert relationship between the United States and Israel. Also, Glenda Riley contradicts some of the common wisdom about contemporary divorce in America by examining the long history of divorce in America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.